virgin daughter of Babylon, sit on the ground. There is no throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstone and grind meal. Uncover thy locks, make bare thy leg. Uncover the thigh, pass over the rivers. Thy nakedness shall be uncovered. Yea, thy shame shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will not meet thee as a man. As for the Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit thou silent, and get thee into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for thou shalt no more be called the Lady of Kingdoms. I was wroth with my people. I have polluted mine inheritance and given them into thine hand. Thou didst show them no mercy. Upon the ancient hadst thou very heavily laid thy yoke. And thou saidst, I shall be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart, neither didst remember the latter end of it. Therefore, hear now this, thou that art given to pleasure, that dwellest carelessly, that sayest in thine heart, I am, and none else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, neither shall I know the loss of children. But these two things shall come to thee in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come and upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thine enchantments.
Yeah, we should probably stop there. We should probably pause halfway through each chapter at least. This is Isaiah's writing this in 700 BC, thereabouts, 699, 698 BC, around there. So this didn't happen to Judah. I mean, 46 fenced cities of Judah were already taken off by Sennacherib. But they didn't go into Babylonian captivity. And the Babylonians weren't even in any position to put Judah in captivity. At this time, the Babylonians themselves were subjects to the Persians, right? I mean, to the Assyrians. And the Babylonians remained subject to the Assyrians until 612 BC. So Isaiah is prophesying in 700 BC that these people in Jerusalem were going to become a daughter of Babylon and a daughter of the Chaldeans. And they're being told to basically that they better humble themselves, because they're basically going to go into captivity. They'll be grinding their own meal and sitting in the dust, and they'll be exposed like a slave girl is exposed to her master, which is basically these first two verses. So the people of Judah are being told this by Isaiah here, that they're going into that captivity. And that they will know the loss of children, and they will know widowhood, and that happened in the captivity. It's the nation as a wife became a widow, she became divorced, and lost her children. But it didn't happen for another 1520 years. That's one more reason why that there's a lot of commentators that think that Isaiah was written late, because they don't believe that he could tell the future. They don't believe the Bible, even though they claim to be theologians. So they rather believe that Isaiah was written late after the Babylonian captivity. I don't know how they're going to date Daniel after the fall of Rome, though, because Daniel definitely told the future for 1,000 years. I don't know if anybody has any conversation.
So what enchantment and sorceries, what were they talking about?
Drugs.
Sorcery could be drugs or witchcraft, but witch, drugs are a form of witchcraft.
Yeah, but it's not pharmakia, the word that's used.
No, it's keshef, but that's basically the word in the Old Testament for sorcery.
Yeah, because it's not Greek, right, Martin? I mean, unless you're taking it.
It's Hebrew.
Yeah,
true.
It's Hebrew.
Right? True, okay.
I mean, it's the same story, right? We like to think that there were no drugs around until the modern age, but that's total horseshit. There was tons of drugs for thousands of years, and there were periods of time when nations got completely hooked on them, just like today.
I mean, if you want me to take the time to look up the way the Hebrew word was used throughout the scripture, I could probably do that. But that might take a minute.
The Septuagint, it
was translated as pharmakia. It's pharmakia. I'm looking at the Septuagint Greek. It was translated as pharmakia. The word for sorcery is sometimes translated as enchantments, but or sorcerers is the same word. It only appears in 12 verses. So it's in Exodus chapter 7 as sorcerers. It's in Exodus chapter 22 as witch. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Deuteronomy chapter 18, it's witch. There shall not be found among you anyone that makes his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that uses divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch. And I'll explain what I believe is the connection in a few. It's witchcrafts relating to Jezebel in 2 Kings chapter 9. It's witchcraft in 2 Chronicles 33:6, where it's basically talking about the son of Hezekiah, Manasseh, who got into witchcraft and all the evils of the time, enchantments and idolatry. In Isaiah chapter 44, verse 9, it's sorceries. In 47:12, it's sorceries. 27:9, Jeremiah 27:9, it's sorcerers. Daniel chapter 2, verse 2, it's sorcerers. And there it says magicians and the astrologers and the sorcerers and the Chaldeans. So we see that a magician and an astrologer and a sorcerer are three different things, right? Just like back in Exodus chapter 7, it was sorcerers and magicians.
So when they use the term observer of times, what exactly were they referring to?
An observer of times? Probably to an augur, I would think. An astrologer or an augur. Let me look up the word observer. Yeah, Deuteronomy 18:10, an observer of times. That's the same word, to practice witchcraft or sorcery. Observer. So
there's a difference in that time. There was a difference between a magician and a sorcerer.
Well, there must have been, because they're listed together quite often. There must have been a difference. his daughter to pass through the fire. Mantua Mahi, prophesying, that's divination here. The observer of times, that comes from one word, right? It's a Greek verb, kleidonizo, which means to give a sign or an omen, or to receive a sign or an omen.
Microphone muted.
And the King James Version, that's how the Hebrew word is translated in the Septuagint. But the King James Version translated as observer of times. Now, the Hebrew definition, the definition of the Hebrew word is to practice divination, right? So, observer of times is just someone who divines or who claims to have seen omens. And that's what I said about augury, that it was probably an augur. An augur would, among the ancient Greeks, this is recorded. It's recorded in all the Homeric literature and all the epic poems, and also in the tragic poets. They would take that there were different kinds of augurs, or augurs did different kinds of things. They saw different kinds of omens, right? That they would wait for a bird, and if it came from the left, it was a bad omen, and if it came from the right, it was a good omen. So the Greek word for left is euonomia. And that's believed to be sarcastic, because euonomia means good omen. Other augurs, or at diverse times, they would sacrifice an animal and open it up and inspect its liver. And if they saw any defects in his liver, that was a bad omen. And if they didn't see any defects, it was a good omen. And you would hire an augur to look for an omen, and he might like tear up the fatted calf and find a bad liver and tell you not to do what it was that you wanted to do because it would be bad, and you would base your life on that.
So they also had the oracles, right, where they had the oracle that would sit over the pits, like at Delphi.
Yeah, right. Well, they would be false prophets.
And the thing was that the pit was, there was supposed to be a snake that was, you know, putting out the gases, whatever. And it was supposed to be like a python, right?
Well, they called it the python. They didn't know what was putting out the gases. And it was probably just natural gas leaking out of the earth. But they attributed that to a snake.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that the Jews, they have that Knights of Pythias.
Okay, that's the same thing.
Yeah, the pythons. It's a den of vipers.
The Greek tale is that Apollo threw the snake down into this pit at Delphi, and it died and emitted this gas that was attributed to Apollo getting the power of divination from the serpent. So the priestesses at Delphi were priestesses of Apollo. And their oracles were always very ambiguous. And they were so ambiguous that Apollo was given the epithet of Loxias. Loxias in Greek means slantwise or crosswise. And it was used to describe ambiguity instead of being euthys or direct. You were Lothius or slantwise, and that was used to describe ambiguity. Because all of the oracles were ambiguous. They could mean anything, a lot of them. They could be interpreted in a ton of ways. They really didn't mean anything.
So they were supposed to be getting divination from the steam from a rotting snake?
Yes. I didn't make the story up. I can just repeat it. Now, to me, pharmakia is witchcraft, because you're taking unclean substances into your body, hoping to gain some healing effect from the substance that's really only going to hurt you. And you're putting your trust in this unclean substance, and that's witchcraft. And if you looked at how, if you read how in the classics, this is explained a few times, the Greek physicians, if they saw that you looked yellow, then they would give you sulfur to eat. If they saw that you looked green, that they would probably give you copper sulfite to eat, or some other green substance. And they thought that they could cure you by giving you some substance from the earth to eat that was the same color as your disease, I swear.
Did that tie in with the humors? The color of the bodily fluids?
Yeah, well, it was basically just friggin' sorcery. I really don't think that they might be more scientific today, but I really don't think that the pharmaceutical companies today are much better.
Tim? Yeah, no, pharmaceuticals today is mostly just about profits. There's very little actual research in it.
Yeah, it's about a bunch of rabbis making opioids.
Yeah, especially when it comes to antidepressants or painkillers.
Yeah, that shit's all hocus pocus, I know.
If you're sad, read the Bible and pray. That's how I do it.
They treat the symptoms, but they never treat the source. And if you are sick or have some sort of ailment, anytime you put in something unnatural into you, it's going to prolong that ailment and eventually cause further problems.
Exactly.
It's like if you get a cold or a flu and you take some over-the-counter stuff, you feel a little better because, you know, your nose ain't dripping and your headache goes away, but you're going to have that flu for like 2 weeks, where it would have been 2 or 3 days likely had you not taken anything and just suffered for those 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, I haven't taken any medicine ever since I was a kid. Not even like just the flu medicine. I would just stick with tea, maybe, some honey, and then sleep in water.
And like another problem is, I find that, okay, so people will take over-the-counter things that generally try to stay away from prescription drugs. But what they're doing is they're taking that something that's actually so cheap, so crappy, that in many ways it could be much worse. You know, that you can buy like 100 extra strength Tylenols for like $6 or something. If you're taking something that's 6 cents a pop, how good could it possibly be for you?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not rocket science. If something is that cheap, it's garbage.
On to 10.
Yeah, why not?
For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am, and none else beside me. Therefore shall evil come upon thee. Thou shalt know from whence it riseth. And mischief shall fall upon thee. Thou shalt not be able to put it off. And desolation shall come upon thee suddenly, which thou shalt not know. Stand now with thine enchantments and with the multitude of thy sorceries, wherein thou hast labored from thy youth. If so be thou shalt be able to profit, if so be thou mayest prevail. Thou art wearied in the multitude of thy counsels. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save thee from these things that shall come upon thee. Behold, They shall be as stubble. The fire shall burn them. They shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. There shall not be a coal to warm at, nor fire to set before it. Thus shall be unto thee with whom thou hast labored, even thy merchants from thy youth. They shall wander every one to his quarter. None shall save thee. In the 47.
Well, I mean, the same exact situation is prevalent today, right? How many women are on birth control pills today in our society? Probably half of them. How many people are on mind-altering drugs? I'm speaking about anxiety medications or ADHD medication or whatever concocted freaking ailment that the psychologist can come up with. Xanax and shit like that. How many people are on that stuff today? And that they think that they're righteous doing that stuff. But Yahweh gave us food laws and told us what we should eat and what we shouldn't. So we basically flaunt his law because some Jew told us that this is good for us. And the Jew is really just a sorcerer. All he is a sorcerer. But half the world is taken by his sorcery. And when you go all the way to the book of Revelation, pharmakia is condemned on several occurrences in the book of Revelation. But people think it's okay. Even Christian church-going Christians are caught up in all this bullshit. And they think it's okay because it's science. I don't know where science is in the Bible. I know the wisdom of this world is condemned in the Bible. That's science. It's condemned in the scripture. And now we have, with all our drugs, we have more disease than we've ever had. I don't really think the drugs have helped us one bit. I mean, yeah, sure, it might have kept some heart patients alive for a few extra years or whatever, mostly just so hospitals and doctors could bleed more money out of them. Maybe it hasn't kept them alive much longer at all. Maybe they'd have been better off without the stuff.
Yeah, that Coca-Cola, it was supposedly started by Pemberton in Atlanta, but it was actually formulated in Jacob's Pharmacy in Atlanta, which was owned by a rabbi.
Yeah, I wouldn't doubt it.
Back when it had cocaine.
And Coca-Cola is straight garbage. It's horrible for you.
Once people figured out that, you know, what cocaine would do to you, they took out the cocaine. Now it'll just rot your teeth out and give you diabetes.
Yeah.
Your bones too.
Yeah, it's not natural to eat that much sugar. I know some people drink 10, 12 pops a day. They can't stay away from this stuff. And they're 50 pounds overweight and they wonder why. Sean Winkler, he's one of them. Can't stay away from that sugar. No more questions about 47? Stargazers. Okay. 48.
Hear ye this, O house of Jacob, which are called by the name of Israel, and are come forth out of the waters of Judah, which swear by the name of the Lord and make mention of the God of Israel, but not in the truth, nor in righteousness. For they call themselves of the holy city and stay themselves upon the God of Israel. The Lord of hosts is his name. I have declared the former things from the beginning, and they went forth out of my mouth, and I showed them. I did them suddenly, and they came to pass, because I knew that thou art obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and thy brow brass. I have even from the beginning declared it to thee. Before it came to pass, I showed it to thee. Lest thou shouldest say, my idol hath done them, and my graven image, and my molten image hath commanded them. Thou hast heard, see all this, and will not ye declare it? I have showed thee new things from the time, even hidden things, and thou didst not know them. They are created now, and not from the beginning, even before the day, when thou heardest them not, lest thou shouldest say, behold, I knew them. Yea, thou heardest not, yea, thou knewest not, yea, from that time that thine ear was not opened, for I knew that thou wouldest deal very treacherously, and was called transgressor from the womb. For my name's sake will I defer mine anger, and for my praise will I refrain for thee, that I cut thee not off. Behold, I have refined thee, but not with silver. I have chosen thee in the furnace of affliction. End of verse 10.
Over and over again, I mean, Exodus chapter 32, 33, 34, Deuteronomy chapter 9, chapter 10, that Yahweh told the children of Israel, they're a stiff-necked people, they're a stiff-necked people. He expected them to be nothing but a stiff-necked people. Yeah, he did tell them from the beginning. He's saying he knew ahead of time that they were going to sin. Yeah, he did know ahead of time they were going to sin.
Microphone muted.
That they were going to fail. That the old kingdom was going to fail. He knew it ahead of time. He had to know it because he had to know that the Lamb was slain from the beginning of the world. And that he would have to come and relieve them of their sins. So here he's telling them they knew it, but people still don't get it. We still don't get it because we don't learn from history. We're separated from our history. If we weren't separated from our history, perhaps, and didn't focus so much on convincing people of that, perhaps we could teach people right. Because of we could better teach them these patterns that are always absolutely certain. When you sin, your society's going to decay and you're going down a shithole into oblivion. That's just the way it is. So we repeat these same mistakes because we don't realize our identity and our history. So Yahweh did declare the former things from the beginning, and he showed them, and they came to pass. Yes, it's all over the Bible. The books of Moses and Samuel and Kings and Chronicles that preceded this. because I knew that thou art obstinate, and thy neck is an iron sinew, and that's stiff-necked, right? I mean, that kind of describes stiff-necked, and we see that stiff-necked used to describe Israel 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 times in Exodus and Deuteronomy. By brow brass. That's pretty good. Today we say somebody's thick-headed, right? Here it says, thy brow is brass. Verse 5 is interesting. It portrays the people as if that they attributed the works of God to their own idols. But he's deferring his anger for his name's sake.
User disconnected from your channel.
That's all I have to say. If anybody has any questions, that's fine.
Verse 11.
Why not?
For mine own sake, even for mine own sake, will I do it. For how should my name be polluted? And I will not give my glory unto another. Hearken unto me, O Jacob, and Israel, my called. I am he, I am the first, I also am the last. Mine hand also hath laid the foundation of the earth, and my right hand hath spanned the heavens. When I call unto them, they stand up together. All ye, assemble yourselves, and hear which among them hath declared these things. Yahweh hath loved him. He will do his pleasure on Babylon, and his arm shall be on the Chaldeans. I have spoken. Yea, I have called him. I have brought him, and he shall make his way prosperous. Come ye near unto me. Hear ye this. I have not spoken in secret from the beginning. From the time that I was, there am I. And now, the Lord God and his Spirit hath sent me. Thus saith Yahweh, thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord thy God, which teaches thee to profit, which leadeth thee by the way that thou shouldest go. Oh, that thou hadst hearkened to my commandments, then had thy peace been as a river, and thy righteousness as the waves of the sea. Thy seed also had been as the sand, and the offering and the offspring of thy bowels like the gravel thereof. His name should not have been cut off nor destroyed from before me. Go ye forth of Babylon, flee ye from the Chaldeans, with a voice of singing declare ye, tell this, utter it even to the end of the earth. Say, Yahweh hath redeemed his servant Jacob. And they thirsted not when he led them through the desert. He caused the waters to flow out of the rock for them. He clave the rock also, and the waters gushed out. There is no peace, saith Yahweh, unto the wicked. End of 48.
Yeah. I'm debating with some clown right now that thinks that he claims he don't believe in a Trinity, but he believes that Jesus is a separate person from God, but he's not understanding that Paul said that Jesus is the image of God's person, so he's not a separate person from God. If we have one Redeemer and Yahweh says that he's the Redeemer, then how could we have two different gods? If Christ is the Redeemer, he must be Yahweh. I mean, that's, I can't see that any other way. I will never see that any other way. But we have Trinitarians even in CI. It's pretty sad.
What is this, on Facebook?
Yeah, it's Flavio. Flavio, hear me. He's arguing. He's trying to argue with me again. He didn't answer me today, though. I sent him a he answered me last night thinking he was smart. I gave him a bunch of answers today, and he didn't answer me today. Good old day. I mean, I did this at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock this morning. So I'll wait. I told him I was an he was an idolater. If you believe in more, that there's two persons or more than one God, then you're an idolater, period. Christ is the image of God's person. He's the image of Yahweh's person, Hebrews chapter 1. So he can't possibly be another person. He's the image of God's person. And screw Trinity and screw the Catholics. I don't care. They're wrong.
I agree with people that ask that all the time on Telegram.
Yeah.
Or I have to talk to people about how everyone's going to be saved. And then I come out and I find out, oh, this guy doesn't even understand that God didn't make blacks. That's what usually happens anyways.
Of course not. Well,
I mean, it's because fundamentally, most people would rather just believe in what they want to believe in instead of what's really true.
Yeah, I understand. It takes some study to wrap your head around a concept, but it's right there in the scripture. And if unless you want to pit one half of the scriptures against the other half, you have to understand it and take the time to understand it in a way that there are no conflicts, because we can't assume that God lied. Well, here we have in chapter 47, this premonition that they're going to be in going into Babylonian captivity, and here they're being told to flee the Chaldeans. So it's another premonition of captivity, but it indicates that they're not going to be in Babylonian captivity long. That they're going to be giving in an escape from it. We won't really know how many Judeans, Judahites of the Babylonian captivity, departed from Babylon to go and migrate into Europe with the rest of them, but there must have been at least some. That there's no way to know that, though. I can't tell. Josephus and other historical sources lead us to believe that, and even the book of Acts, that some Judahites remained in northern Arabia and in and around Babylonia, where they were taken captive. Some remained there all the way past the time of Christ. But it couldn't have been any tremendously great number, as Josephus explained that the 10 tribes were an innumerable multitude beyond the Euphrates. He didn't describe the Judahites that stayed in Coel Assyria or around Babylonia as an innumerable multitude. He just didn't. But there must have been some. Peter was the apostle to the circumcision. That's why he was in Babylon when he wrote his first epistle, because there were people of the circumcision still there, evidently. coupling Jacob and Israel together with this concept of a redeemer, I mean, I don't know how the churches believe that Christ came to redeem anybody else, because it's not possible under the law. It's not within the paradigm of Scripture. You can only redeem what was yours to begin with. Yahweh has redeemed his servant Jacob. There's no way around that. And there's no way of making excuses that anybody else could have been redeemed. The prophets don't allow it. I guess that's why the Catholics don't read the prophets. I went to Catholic school for 10 years. I don't remember one reference to the prophets, not one. Martin? I guess Martin went to the bathroom.
No, every time the phone resets itself, so I had to do the whole process to get back into it.
Wow.
49?
Your phone resets itself. That's crazy.
It shuts down.
Really?
It's going to be locks. So be the correct. 49?
I gather.
Listen, O isles, unto me, and hearken, ye people from afar. Yahweh hath called me from the womb. From the bowels of my mother hath he made mention of my name. And he hath made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand hath he hid me, and made me a polished shaft. In his quiver hath he hid me, and said unto me, Thou art my servant, O Israel, in whom I will be glorified. Then I said, I have labored in vain. I have spent my strength for naught, and in vain. Yet surely my judgment is with Yahweh, and my work with my God. And now saith Yahweh, that formed me from the womb to be his servant, to bring Jacob again to him. Though Israel be not gathered, yet shall I be glorious in the eyes of Yahweh, and my God shall be my strength. And he said, It is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, that thou mayest be my salvation unto the end of the earth. Thus saith Yahweh, the Redeemer of Israel and his Holy One, to him man despiseth, to him whom the nations abhorreth, to a servant of rulers. Kings shall see and arise, princes also shall worship, because of Yahweh that is faithful and the Holy One of Israel, and he shall choose thee. Thus saith Yahweh, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation have I helped thee, and I will preserve thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people, to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages, that thou mayest say to the prisoners, Go forth, to them that are in darkness. Show yourselves. They shall feed in the ways, and their pastures shall be in all high places. They shall not hunger nor thirst, neither shall the heat nor sun smite them. For he that have mercy on them shall lead them, even by the springs of water shall he guide them. End of chapter, verse 10.
Yeah, Paul quoted this passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, speaking to Corinthians, right? When then, as workers together with him, beseech you, we then, as workers together with him, beseech you that you also receive not the grace of God in vain. And that's exactly in the context of this chapter. And then he said, for he says, I have heard thee in a time accepted, and in a day of salvation I have succored thee. Behold, now is the accepted time, now is the day of salvation. He's actually citing this passage that we read here, that you just read in verse 8. Thus saith Yahweh, in an acceptable time have I heard thee, and in a day of salvation I have helped thee. So the King James Version translated that as succored, the equivalent Greek word. But that's okay, because to succor someone is to help them. And the Hebrew word means to help or to succor or to support. And I will preserve thee and give thee for a covenant of the people to establish the earth, to cause to inherit the desolate heritages. And the way Paul, the way this reads, it is a little difficult, because prophetic language often has double meanings. And it seems to be speaking about only the promised Messiah, about Christ. But then it seems to be speaking about Jacob collectively. And Paul is actually, and I didn't say this in my Corinthians, I don't think I said this in my Corinthians commentary, but maybe I should have. Paul is actually bridging that in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, chapter 6, by stating that when we become workers with Christ, workers in the message of the gospel, then we have a share in what's being said in Isaiah chapter 49. He's bridging that where it seems to be addressing just Christ, or is it addressing Israel? Paul's bridging that by saying that we have this opportunity to join Christ in that. And that's how we receive that succor and that help and that salvation as a race. That, I believe, is... I believe that is an element of Paul's genius, if you want to say that, but really his understanding of scripture, that he could bridge that concept, those two concepts here in Isaiah 49, where it seems to be speaking about a Messiah, but then it seems to be speaking to Israel as a whole. And he basically explains it in that really simple language in 2 Corinthians 6, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know if that makes sense to y'all, but that's where I see that. So it seems like a Messiah is being spoken to here, but then Israel collectively is being spoken to here at the same time. Especially it says, and he said, it is a light thing that thou shouldest be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the preserved of Israel. I will also give thee for a light to the Gentiles, to the nations, that thou mayest be my salvation on the ends of the earth. And that seems to be more specific of a Messiah. But a lot of this language is more general of Israel. I think Paul is bridging that gap in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. And basically saying that this is speaking of Christ, and whoever joins him through an acceptance of the gospel is engaging in this role. There's an underlying theme here that Israel is hid. And that's absolutely true. In the centuries after the Assyrian deportations, the children of Israel were forgotten, that they forgot themselves. They exactly were hid. They were the prisoners sitting in darkness. They forgot who they were, that they were in captivity. They were stripped of all their belongings, all their civilization, all their culture, as it's prophesied here in Isaiah and also in Hosea. So they were basically shepherds living off cattle on the European steppes and had nothing and had to begin a whole new civilization anew in Europe, which took 1,000 years to do. It took over 1,000 years just to start. I don't know if there's anything anybody wants to discuss that maybe I haven't seen the importance of. No. You're a quiet bunch tonight. I'm sorry if I'm making noise. I'm trying to eat quietly as I do this. Not always possible.
And I will make all my mountains away, and my highways shall be exalted. Behold, these shall come from far and low, these from the north and from the west, and these from the land of Sinim. Sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains, for Yahweh hath comforted his people, and will have mercy upon his afflicted. But Zion said, Yahweh hath forsaken me, and my Lord hath forgotten me. Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yea, they may forget, yet will I not forget thee. Behold, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. The children shall make haste, thy destroyers, and they that made thee waste shall go forth of thee. Lift up thine eyes round about, and behold, all these greater than gather themselves together and come to thee. As I live, saith Yahweh, thou shalt surely clothe thee with them all, as with an ornament, and bind them on thee, as a bride doeth. For thy waste and thy desolate places in the land of thy destruction shall even now be too narrow by reason of the inhabitants, and they that swallow thee up shall be far away. The children which thou shalt have after thou hast lost the other shall say again in thine ears, the place is too strait for me. Give place to me that I may dwell. Then shalt thou say in thine heart, who hath begotten me these, seeing I have lost my children and am desolate, a captive, and removing to and fro? And who hath brought up these? Behold, I was left alone. These, where had they been? Thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I will lift up mine hand to the Gentiles and set up my standard to the people, and they shall bring thy sons in their arms, and thy daughters shall be carried upon their shoulders. And the kings shall be thy nursing fathers, and the queens thy nursing mothers. They shall bow down to thee with their face toward the earth and lick up the dust of thy feet, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh, for they shall not be ashamed that wait for me. Shall the prey be taken from the mighty, or the lawful captive delivered? But thus saith Yahweh, even the captives of the mighty shall be taken away, and the prey of the terrible shall be delivered. For I will contend with him that contendeth with thee, and I will save thy children, and I will feed them that oppress thee with their own flesh, and they shall be drunken with their own blood as with sweet wine. And all flesh shall know that I am Yahweh, am the Savior of thy Redeemer, and the Mighty One of Jacob. In 49.
Well, this synonym might be a reference to China. It's hard to tell. And sometimes the Greeks called China Ceres. In Sanskrit, it's Sina. In modern Greek, modern Greek is really Turk, right? In my opinion, it's Kina. The place is otherwise unmentioned.
So where was that?
Mentioned anywhere else. It's said to mean thorns, but yeah, the land of thorns, that makes sense. Basically, the Huns and the Goths, the Massagete, lived bordering on China for many centuries before they migrated westward. They lived bordering on China for in some cases as many as 8 centuries before they migrated westward. So that might be how I would interpret that if I did a commentary. That's probably how I would interpret it. They didn't all go directly to the west. They went north. The Israelites in captivity went north and west. Some of them went east, and they stayed east for a long time. The Huns were pulling raids on China in the 3rd century, I think, maybe the 2nd century AD. While others had migrated west and sacked Rome instead. So that may very well be a reference to that land in Asia that we know as China today. I can't say that with any definite certainty, though, because Sinim just means thorns, the land of thorns. There's another prophecy in Isaiah that they would, in reference to the children of Israel, that they would break out on the right and on the left, and that's always indicated to me. That's in Isaiah chapter 54. For thou shalt break forth on the right hand and on the left, and thy seed shall inherit the Gentiles. Well, later in Jeremiah, those same children of Israel are addressed as being in the north, and they went to the right hand and the left, meaning that they migrated east and west, right? So if we put that together with this chapter, then the reference to Sinim seems to be a reference to China. And the Israelites, tribes of Israel, did border on China for a long time. So it's possible that's what's referenced here as the land of Sinim. That's plausible.
I've also heard the theory that Sinim is like a place like maybe around the Red Sea or like in southern Israel or something, but I'm not sure if that's really the case.
Sinai?
Yeah, somewhere in that region, but I'm not sure.
Well, Sinai also means thorny, so yes, it could. It's possible that it does. That's the more obvious. Immediate reference, but that's not that where the children of Israel went into captivity. It's not likely that they ended up in Sinai. And especially, in my opinion, because later on in history, that there are none of the children of Israel found in Sinai.
Well, I think you're right.
If the Judeans had known about large numbers of Israelites in Sinai, which is to the south, then you'd think it would appear in Josephus or somewhere in the New Testament or the books of the later prophets, but it doesn't happen.
I mean, even Ethiopia, right? We have records of Israelites there, and yet we don't really hear about anything from Sinai. Maybe there's something about Sinim versus like Sinai or something like that, because I remember in Genesis 10 there was a tribe that had a similar name. But on the other hand, maybe it's the other way around, right? And maybe the Chinese are named after some Adamic tribe that went there in ancient times. I mean, I've heard like stories about like maybe, I don't know, the Chinese and how they actually got their civilization from the West, right? But I, like I said, I don't really know for sure.
I mean, I don't know, because I never cared to study China, because it's like studying any other shithole. How did that happen? It happened through sin. That's how it happened. And that's all we needed. That's all I need to know. But well, I do believe that the earliest advanced cultures in China were white cultures. And I have read, I never followed up on it to see if it was true or not, but I have read that a lot of the words used in China to describe things that are associated with advanced cultures, like sailing and boats and ships and things like that, are really Hebrew or Sanskrit words, which I believe Sanskrit's a derivative of Hebrew and not the other way around. But well, it's almost doubtless that there was white influences that had birthed civilization in China. And it's very apparent that those people are all mixed. They're not a pure race. That they're all, I mean, it's apparent that certain tribes of them, that all of them look very similar, but there are many different tribes in China. That's how you end up with basketball players that are 8 feet tall that are Chinese. They're mixed. They're not as pure as we think they are, or we're led to believe they are. Then there's always the Chinese with the horns going out of their heads and stuff like that. That's kind of interesting.
Cain went east of Eden.
I mean, apparently like the original, I guess, group in Japan, the Jomon or whatever they're called, like apparently they're like mixed, right? They're not like purely Asian, because like they can grow facial hair, and like their facial features look more like Europeans. Not the same, but like there's obviously like something going on there. Yeah, the Ainu, right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, I've heard stories about some of them having like green eyes and like having brown hair and like being able to grow facial hair, not black hair like the Asians. Too.
I've actually seen pictures. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to talk over you.
I said I've seen pictures similar to that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, all I was saying is not to say that they're pure, though. They definitely aren't, but there must be something going on there.
Yeah, well, I do believe that probably Japhethi tribes and other Shemite tribes and Israelites as well all probably migrated into Asia in chunks at one time or another and mingled in with, well, yellow monkeys or something. I don't know how Shinx came to be, but I don't believe that Yahweh created them. I think they're all bastards. And their dragon worship and all of the fruits of their nations, I think, proves that.
Well, that's just really the thing, right? Like, I see some of these, I guess, quote-unquote moderate CI people. They say non-whites are beasts, but that's not true. They're all bastards. All of them are mixed. Like, you can look into the history of any, like, non-white people, and you'll see they're, like, mixed. Like, they're all race mixed. You can look into it. They really are. So, no, they're not, like, pure. That's not how it works.
Well, right. I agree. And that's my position since I've been doing this. Since at least 2001, probably. My first couple of years with hashing it all out with Clifton. Because he had a lot of old CI ideas too when we started. It's baggage we had to get rid of. We had to get rid of the baggage before we could figure it out. In all the early CI literature, you'll read that God created three races, a white race, a black race, and a yellow race. No, that's not true at all.
Well, no, you got a white race and then three branches of it, right, for the three sons of Noah. That's what you got.
Yeah, and the rest are all bastards. I agree. They're all goats. They all go to a lake of fire prepared for the devil and his angels. I have a lot of that's always been my teaching as long as I've been doing this. I have a lot of opposition to that in traditional old school CI circles. I always have. They actually want to believe Yahweh created niggers. They really do. They'll argue in favor of niggers.
That's like the Mormons, where they say, you know, that there was a third of the angels revolted and that they were cast down to earth. And then, the ones who didn't do anything, who were lazy and didn't do anything, they were cast down as niggers, and the ones who fought alongside God, were cast down as white.
Of course, the lazy ones were the niggers.
So that's why they think that the spirits were in heaven and then they went into bodies. Okay.
That's a Mormon thing too.
Which I mean,
and that's Paul, what Wesley Swift believed. Wesley Swift had adopted that bullshit.
Swift?
Yeah, Wesley Swift held the Mormon belief that we were created in heaven and sent down here in earthly bodies. Yeah. Crazy.
Well, I would just ask him, where's that in the Bible?
Yeah.
Well, they get it from one verse, from a misreading of one verse, and it's in Job, about how the sons of God had rejoiced when the heavens were created. I'll find it. Wow. Nope. Okay. Let me just look at the phrase, sons of God. I know it's in there. Job 38:7. Whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. And Wesley Swift took that literally, that when the earth was created, that the sons of God were in heaven. And from that one verse, he taught that we were sent down here as spirits into fleshly bodies When a baby's born, a spirit sent into it by God that was in heaven, and now he has to live life on earth until that body dies. Yeah, that was Wesley Swift. And it's just like the Mormon belief. Wow. And it's just nuts to me. It's just crazy. And this verse doesn't mean that at all.
Reminds me is that the whole idea of Christ being like the only begotten Son of God comes from, funnily enough, the Latin Vulgate, not from the Greek text. But even that's a mistranslation, because in the Vulgate, it says only engendered, because like as in physical birth, not as in like, I guess being like, I don't know how to describe it, but it doesn't mean like exactly the same thing as like only begotten. If that makes sense.
Well, I've explained that. My own opinion on that isn't quite like that, but I've explained it several times in my commentaries where that word monogenes appears, probably in John chapter 3 and also in Hebrews. I think the more complete description of it's probably in my Hebrews commentary. Where in the Old Testament, that word monogenes was translated from a Hebrew term that meant most loved. That's all it meant. And Isaac was the monogenes son of Abraham in the Septuagint. Well, how could he be when he had an older brother? So how could that be taken literally? It can't be.
Well, wouldn't it mean like something like firstborn or like, you know, first is in, you know, in terms of inheritance, right? Or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, well, that would be the most loved son or the most beloved son or whatever. It just doesn't mean only born. It doesn't mean that. Taken literally, it could mean what you would explain at the beginning about it being the only engendered, but it wasn't used that way in the Septuagint, was my point. It was used of a favored son or a most loved son, which is why I translated as most beloved, I believe.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
I translated according to how it was used in the Septuagint because I believe that the Septuagint, the apostles quoted it all the time. And even when they weren't native Greek speakers, I believe that the Septuagint was the biggest Greek influence on their understanding of words. That they would have used words as they were, as they meant, according to what they meant in the Septuagint. So whenever I had words that were obscure in the New Testament and I wasn't satisfied with the Liddell and Scott definitions of those words, even words that weren't so obscure, I went to the Septuagint and checked every occurrence of the word in the Septuagint to see how it was used there. That was my habit when I translated the Christogenic New Testament. I probably did it with 100 words. I don't know. A lot. Well, this is interesting in verse 16 here. Behold, I have graven thee, and Yahweh speaking to Israel, I have graven thee upon the palms of my hands. Thy walls are continually before me. So there was no way the children of Israel were going to escape what Yahweh had planned for them, and that meant their salvation, their redemption. It certainly doesn't describe Jews, and it certainly can't apply to any other people. On an esoteric level, you might think that graven me upon the palms of my hands represented the nails of the cross, but the nails of the cross could not have gone through the palms of the hands. The Romans typically put them through the two arm bones running into the wrist, which could support the body weight much better.
Because
the palms of the hands, the nails would just rip out. They wouldn't support the body weight at all.
Or the writing is on the wall, right? That it's set in stone.
Yeah, right, that too.
So what you were saying about the about Sinem and that you said something about the Turks, that the modern Greek, something about the Greeks and the Turks.
Yeah, that Sina, I think it should have been Sina originally, and in modern Greek it's Kina, it's with a K. But our China is right between those two.
What about China being between the which two?
The way we say China is right between Sina and Kina, basically.
Got it. Okay. So how does that tie in with the Turks?
It's Kina.
That the Turks would have been Orientals?
I'm just explaining what the word China is spelled in modern Turkish, how it's pronounced in modern Turkish. In Greek, it was also Seres in ancient Greek, S-E-R-E-S. And in Rome, in Latin, it was Serica. So that's completely different from the Sina of the... Or Sina or Kina of the Sanskrit. I'm not sure how the Sanskrit's pronounced.
Chapter 50, next week.
Yeah.